we are running as fast as we can on a bridge. With each step we take, we're just hoping that we've built the slat that our foot's going to land on. We don't know what the next slat is or what's around the corner until we come upon it. And so just embrace that. But I believe that God created us to be builders. So when we're building, it's just incredibly fulfilling. So I'm just enjoying the moment. You know, find joy in the journey.
That is a fast, much faster path. Talk about, you know, speed to market, but path to revenue for us.
The moat of intellectual property. The second moat is the brand.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Breakout CEO Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Holman with Intellectual Strategies. We're a law firm that works with a lot of up-and-coming brands and companies, and we get to talk with CEOs about things that are going on in their companies. That's usually confidential information, so we can't share those secrets, but we've got this podcast that we've started talking with CEOs and advisors to CEOs who are scaling companies, and we get to see some of the behind-the-scenes problems, insights, solutions. And so it's really special that we have people like Romney Williams here today to help us see some of these things, share some of the things that he's going through with his business. Romney, it's really great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Jeff. Really excited.
Yeah, I'm so glad. Well, we did our icebreaker segment recently, and I mentioned that you and I connected about 20 years ago. I'm excited for this part of the recording because I get to hear in more detail the things that have happened between then and now. And of course, we'll dive into some of the specifics of your current company, Dryout, and hear how you've been doing building that over the last 5 years or so. So great to have you. Great to reconnect. If there was something that you were to say, not that we're going to just summarize in one sentence, but what would you say over the last 20 years is a thread that kind of has followed with you over the course of your career?
Yeah, actually, I can see a really clear thread, and it was unintended. It is professionally, I've had the opportunity to lock arms with really smart, ambitious people looking to disrupt an industry. And later in that journey, maybe 7 or 8 years into that journey, another thread was joining founders that didn't want to be CEO, didn't want to lead out. And they're looking for someone that could be the driver on that bus. So I've had the opportunity to do that 4 times, actually. So there's not a common thread in terms of industry, category. It's locking arms with founders and help them raise their baby.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Yeah. Well, so when we first met, you were with a company that I think had sold some technology, or maybe the business as a whole to a client that I was working with. From there, though, I think you've been a SaaS company, and you've done Enzo Rings and maybe something else in between, and now you're at Dryout. Yeah. Give us a flavor for the quick hit on what happened at each of those places.
Yeah, sure. So several chapters in the book. In my career, that company you referenced early on was, so some of us are old enough to remember there was an era in the world where digital cameras didn't exist, right? Our kids can't imagine life without TikTok or Zoom or whatever. So I had the really unique opportunity to join some of the, not only most intelligent, but most intentional and visionary people I've ever worked with. They've spun out of MIT and they developed the image sensor, with the digital camera technology that sits behind the lens, whether it's in your smartphone, your car, computer, which we're looking at each other visually.
Yeah.
So it was an image sensor that converts photons or light into an image. And it was bleeding edge, cutting edge, proprietary technology. And I had the opportunity to join on as the first person on the business side.
Wow.
And with the team, figure out what's our go-to-market strategy, how do we position this technology, how do we convince old companies like a Kodak or a Polaroid at the time to embrace the digital camera revolution before they're disrupted as film companies. So that was really interesting. I had the chance to do that and love that, have some great memories and insights there. And that was, we were acquired by your client. And so when you reached out, you were asking about some of our marketing of our IP and all that. So that's just such a small world. So that was amazing. And I still, though I get no credit for the innovations that we did, it seems like every time I get in my car, if I put it in reverse and I see,
Yeah.
There's a camera in the back, or I'm on a call like this. I reflect on slides in our investor PowerPoint, you know, our deck that showed this technology as a concept.
Wow.
And now that it's just, it's everywhere. And it's so that's really, really cool. So that was really what got me launched in wanting to be a part of disruption and teaming up with really smart, you know, big vision people with values that I shared. So yeah, since then I've played in print technology, insurance technology, enterprise SaaS, consumer products with Enso Rings, which is a premium silicone ring direct consumer brand. Great people, very values driven. And yeah, and then Dryout. That's just been an unintended, but just amazing chapter I feel really fortunate to be a part of.
Well, and I have two follow-ups on that. Going back to the cameras, for those who, you know, maybe don't remember anything other than awesome images and great frame rates, like what was the resolution, or how would you describe the quality of the camera then in today's terms?
That's interesting. We didn't use the term quality. We used the term resolution, right?
Yeah.
So that's basically how many pixels in an image, which for in that time of in the world, that was because people want to know how large, if they were to print it, how large could the print be?
Right.
And so our first image sensor was a VGA resolution. It was 640 by 480. So you were lucky if printed, it looked decent at 2 by 3 inches. So just teeny, but it was okay to view it on a computer screen. And then we had the next breakthrough was a 1.3 megapixel camera. So maybe that prints a 3 by 5, and then we had a 2 megapixel. And now it's what? I don't even know.
I don't know what the max
megapixel
is.
I don't even know, but
it depends on which camera you're talking about on your phone, right? Because there's now like 5 of them.
They're all one upping each other. So yeah, good point. Good point. Anyway, so pretty remarkable.
I love looking back. I mean, it ages me, and maybe all of us a little bit. But but it's cool to see, because you talked to earlier when we were chatting in our icebreaker segment about, you know, just kind of this. I'm going to call it the calling to build, right? Like we have this calling to build and to create, and that's part of it. As you've progressed through these different companies, I'm curious did your roles in the companies also seem to grow and progress? I mean, at that point in time, you were the first business guy with the company. Now you're the CEO. Was that a pretty linear progression over the course of time, or did it kind of jump around?
Yeah, the opportunities I've had to lead in a company, the first time it happened, I was consulting for a founder who had a really big vision in fintech, in the financial services world. And I didn't know the industry at all, other than just being a consumer. And what I realized was I had a little bit of wisdom for my pain and some insights of what founders go through when they've birthed something they believe is really special and they want help, is gaining their trust, understanding, helping them to find their vision and start to plot a course, albeit really hard to see the future. How does he get there? How do they get there? And then, do you want help? And if so, in what areas? Where are your strengths? Where are your shortcomings? Gaps in the plan, gaps in the skill set, resources. Maybe I can help. And so it just started with that kind of a conversation. And then a realization that a lot of times, domain expertise is obviously valuable. But what I've seen in startups, especially when it's just a founder there with an idea, it's a product, it's a service, it's a big vision, there's just a lot that needs to be done, a lot of heavy lifting.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like the framework of a minimum viable product, which is you have hypothesis, right? Scientific method. You build it, a really rough V1. You test it. You measure. What do you learn? And then apply those learnings and repeat, make it a little bit better, understand to get to product market fit. So it's just really being willing to roll up your sleeves, check ego at the door, hopefully, and just grind and be very comfortable being uncomfortable and make sacrifices. And so that, I think that's important when it comes to trust,
because being a founder, I've been a founder on my own, but it's very lonely. So lock arms with someone where there's that inherent trust of, hey, if anyone's going to figure out, I think we are. So I think
you get the excitement from the founder, right? Like the founders already are excited. They have the vision. Their vision is way out there. This is a $1 billion company, right?
Yeah.
They don't, as you mentioned, they don't know the steps at all. When we talked in the icebreaker, you were talking, you know, we referenced both kind of building the airplane as you're falling. And you brought up the awesome imagery of laying the slats down on the bridge as you're running across the bridge.
Yeah.
there's a superpower there, because the founders, the creators, the inventors, they're like, I see the other side of the canyon. Like, that's where we're going to be. But laying down those slats one at a time for 10,000 slats or whatever it takes to get across the canyon, they're not. Most founders who are great at seeing the long-term vision struggle, as you mentioned, with the step-by-step process to get there.
Just a quick note about our guests. I host the Breakout CEO podcast to share behind-the-scenes insights from scaling businesses. As an attorney, I see the real challenges leaders face long before success becomes public. But client stories have to stay confidential. So we invite guest CEOs to share their own moments of struggle and success. I'm so grateful to our guests and my team at Intellectual Strategies for making this show possible. Now, let's get back to the show.
Or there's just so much to do, and it's such a lonely journey that just having someone by your side doing it can make a big difference. And so that's a role that I have tried to fill. And it I genuinely mean this. It's like a sacred stewardship that I feel has been, you know, granted to me is to help someone, you know, raise, figuratively speaking, their baby, their startup, their concept, because it's lonely doing that on your own. And then it's still really hard doing it as a duo or a trio. But yeah, so my hope is people understand my motives are good. Is there self-interest? Yeah, you bet. Because the exhilaration being part of it, like there's nothing for me like that adrenaline of the planning and the execution and just hitting it hard. That's an amazing drug, the adrenaline that's generated, at least for me.
Are there a couple of times along the way where you had some of those adrenaline highs, maybe hitting certain milestones or building something a little bit bigger than you guys thought was possible at these prior companies?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And that really can keep you going. And a lot of times it may be an indicator the outside world thinks, well, that's not a big deal, but you hit a milestone or have a breakthrough that can just keeps you going.
Yeah.
And you've got to look for those. And I had a mentor that was really good at just saying, stop and smell the roses, though you're never satisfied, because you're always, there's a gap between where you are and where you want to be. And I love this book. I don't know if you've read The Gap and the Gain, but similar concept, which is, a lot of our dissatisfaction, lack of happiness as humans lies in the gap between where we want to be or where we should be and where we actually are. So can we measure backwards, see how far we've come? I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. And if you're a high achiever, which I know you are, and have huge aspirations, it's important to stop and smell the roses or look and measure backwards.
I will accept your designation as a high achiever and try to live up to that. And I'll check out the book. So 5 years ago, you know, this is, you know, maybe during COVID or around that time.
Yeah.
You decided to take a swing at dryout. Why you and why dryout?
So when I was trying to figure out what does the next chapter look like, I knew I wanted to find an opportunity to help a founder launch and grow something that had enormous potential, that had IP, and that's obviously one of your areas of expertise, but had legitimate, proven intellectual property, a technology that would open up big opportunities for consumers. And, but how do you find that? A founder that's looking for help. And so that's not something you just
you know, fine talking to people and scouring on LinkedIn. But I was introduced by a friend to an incubator here in Utah called RevRoad. Mm-hmm. And I was meeting with the founder, CEO of RevRoad, Darren Hill, and was explaining what have I explained to you. Here's some things I've done, looking for an opportunity to help a founder raise their baby. And he said, wow, I think I know where we met. Let me tell you about this company. And he proceeded to tell me about Dryout, had a different name at the time, but said, we really think this thing could be enormous. And we've done some vetting and they're in our portfolio company or portfolio, and we're looking for a CEO. And so the introduction was made to the CEO, and I told him my story, and we talked for probably 3 hours, and he had unearthed or birthed something really interesting. And I just said, hey, look, I think for both of us, a date before marriage concept is really good. Let's do 90-day try-by consulting. Let's mm-hmm. figure out what the role would be, like clearly defined role at the day 91 if we decide to keep going. But let's just do this try-by and see if we can work well together. I need to understand the market, the technology, and I just have a lot to learn. And so that was what started that journey.
What prompted you to be looking for IP as maybe one of the factors in the business you wanted to get into? Were some of the prior companies not built on as strong of IP? Or because that's a curious, not every CEO or every business person says IP's got to be part of the equation, and not every business has it, right? So what prompted you to say that?
Yeah, well, I was very fortunate way back when with that MIT spinoff that was called Small Camera Technologies, is the IP that we had was such a game changer. Mm-hmm. And we could prove the performance data was so much better than everyone else that we were taken very seriously, even though there were six of us. And we were going up against literally Toshiba, Hitachi, Sony, Micron, National Semiconductor. It was brutal. But we had our IP was truly the best in the world, and the data proved it. And that's an unfair advantage. And so I found myself looking for that, but that's hard to find as well. And so I was in companies where we had IP, but that IP might be, you know, a SaaS platform or some code that was kind of unique. But what's the differentiator really, other than the brand and the customer base and
maybe softer IP, we might call it,
and
that,
the
right?
team softer IP, yeah. And so, and then when I was with Enso Rings, it was really impressive that one of the founders, the origin story was 100,000 times a year in the United States, someone experiences what's called ring avulsion, where a metal ring either, you know, degloves, tears off fingers, like really horrific stuff.
Wait, 100,000 times a year?
Oh, yeah. Documented in the United States.
Wow.
It's called ring avulsion. Yeah. Jimmy Fallon made it famous when he had a kitchen accident, almost lost his finger with this ring.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, crazy. That was years ago. But what made Enso Rings really unique was the other founder, when they decided, let's do a company of, you know, silicone rings from a safety, comfort, low cost perspective, it was, he just said, I'm not going to be comfortable or satisfied until the silicone ring that I wear on my finger looks like the copper ring that my wife gave me when we got married. Hmm. But how can we infuse copper into silicone and make it look not like a cheap plastic, you know, piece of garbage,
getting,
like with a quarter at the grocery store and like the little, you know, gumball.
You don't want it to look like the bracelets that you get at every right. or you used to get at every event. Yeah.
And so anyway, he just went mad scientist and he figured out how to infuse precious metals inside the process of creating a silicone ring. And so it has the sheen and luster of metal, obviously different colors and size or different, colors. And so that breakthrough, that was true IP. It was patented and it was just a game changer. So I had a little bit of taste of that again. And then with Dryout, what was interesting, you know, the genesis story for Dryout, the founder story, which I think a lot of great companies, it just starts with, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And the founder, Elliot, living in Florida, he completely drenched his iPhone when he was washing his fishing boat and he didn't know how to fix it. I mean, he's worried, he could see it was starting to act really weird. And so he went to Best Buy and asked for, do you have a solution that will pull moisture out of my phone? And
one of the sales associates said, I don't know, maybe like a bowl of rice. And that's a hack a lot of us have heard about. Turns out that there's no science behind that, because rice will absorb moisture, obviously, but it doesn't pull moisture out of a phone or whatever.
Yeah, it's not like it's sucking it through the little ports, the portholes on the phone. You're just hoping that somehow there's enough air transfer of some sort.
And it doesn't work. And we have data that shows literally, like, don't waste the rice.
We can't air this part of the show. That's gonna so many people are gonna feel like their hopes and dreams for their phones have just been crushed.
We have a solution for that. That's the So he ended up trying that, didn't work. Grain of rice got stuck in the charging port, you know, the bottom of the phone. Yeah. And a couple of days later, he had an absolute light bulb moment, an aha moment of, wait, the moisture wicking nylon in my shirt, if I were to impregnate that with silica gel packets that he found in a beef jerky bag, if I made a sandwich of that material and stitched it in the form, you know, form factor, the basically a pouch for a phone, would that have saved my phone? And so he tinkered with that, and turns out, yes, that was genius, and he was able to patent it. And the patent was really broad for, you know, a wet phone rescue pouch, but turns out, oh, it works for AirPods that are in your pocket and go through the watch, the key fob that, you know, falls in the snow. And then, so he started on this journey and sold pouches to QVC and Staples. And then he's a firearm enthusiast. And as a lot of people know, when moisture and air meet on metal, that's oxidation. So it's formation of rust and corrosion. We see it in our tools at home. Right? You just see it all over the place, right? And he was experiencing that with firearms just living in the Southeast. And he realized, oh, wait, that same little pouch for a phone, I can make a little bit bigger. And now it works for a tablet, also works for a handgun or ammo or a camera lens, right? So that helped him with it evolving. But it was a consumer products brand, just selling these products.
And when you say pouch, this is like a bag that I would put my electronics into. Is that what that is?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. And so, yeah. So anyway, so when I was introduced, they're looking for a CEO, having come off an opportunity where I was on the team, you know, leading Enso Rings, great experience, awesome company. But being in that world where, you know, inventory, consumer products, building a consumer brand, educating the market was just not something I was looking for. And going back to early in my career, we talked about when I was with the MIT spinoff, our business model was called an ingredient brand. So we were like an OEM ingredient brand strategy. So we were similar to, if you have a Gore-Tex rain jacket, right? Or a pair of trail running shoes with, Vibram soles, right? These are ingredients in someone else's product, and like an Intel Inside model. So that's what we did in the digital camera world. We were the first company to have cameras inside a car, the 2006 Mercedes S-Class. So having learned and run that playbook years ago, that's always been back in my mind. I'd love to do that again, be an ingredient brand and help really cool brands, other companies make their products better or launch into new categories. And so when I saw what they were doing with the drought technology, I actually saw an opportunity of like, why would we be a consumer products brand if we could be the Gore-Tex of moisture removal?
Right.
And we can get into the story and some of the breakthroughs, but that was really like, oh, that's interesting to me.
Yeah, we'll get into the breakthroughs. But that's said another way. I haven't heard somebody say ingredient brand before, but I know what you're talking about. I've got clients who are integrated into some of these, you know, these product development or distribution stacks, so to speak. But essentially, ingredient brand means you're going to partner with somebody who's got an existing distribution, or you're going to partner with somebody who's doing other pieces of the production or sales process, right? So it's really a partnership play in essence.
It is. And an important distinction about it is the ingredient brand is a component in someone else's finished good.
Yeah.
Right. So a YKK zipper on your jacket, or again, Gore-Tex in your snowboard pants. So Gore-Tex is an ingredient that makes it more innovative, obviously waterproof. And the North Face or Arc'teryx or whomever, Columbia, they could choose from all sorts of different material suppliers, but they choose Gore-Tex because, one, the membrane is waterproof and it performs really well. But two, there's some brand equity mm-hmm. to be able to say these pants have Gore-Tex in them compared to the pants that don't. They can charge more and there's more brand. You get brand equity, customer loyalty. So that's why it's called an ingredient brand, like the Intel inside a computer.
Well, so your background really, this wasn't just a random jump from one company to the next company. This was you saying, I understand the value of IP. I've done consumer facing stuff. I've been part of ingredient brand model. And so this is kind of coming together, bringing together a lot of the different things that you had done and probably built strengths in, it sounds like.
Yeah, not intentional. Meaning I wasn't thinking I'm building a foundation so that I then can launch an ingredient brand in
sure.
the material space, right? But it was just, it was very foundational. And then these different chapters that I've had the opportunity to be a part of, it gave me lenses through which I could view this opportunity with Dryout, which is, let's don't be a consumer brand. Let's be an ingredient in hundreds of products launched by, dozens and dozens of different brands.
What did the team look like? Was it really just the founder at that point and you joined him? So you're like the two of you just essentially co-founder mode and let's take it. Was he selling at that point, making the product?
Yeah. So finished goods, they're being sourced at the time from China, pouches for phones, gun bags, and they're being sourced from China and selling primarily online e-commerce and then mm-hmm. some on Amazon and then in the wholesale channel. So through retailers, sporting goods stores but pretty hard time to do it. It was during those early days of COVID and it was tricky. It was challenging, but he was very gritty. Elliot is just, he is a grinder, like nothing's going to stop him. And I really admire that. And that absolutely is beyond imperative for any entrepreneur, is just incessant, drive and bias for action.
Yeah, because if he was doing all these things by the time you joined him, I would guess he was in the game for 8 or 10 years leading up to that point. This was not...
It had been a few years, that he was doing it and just doing it on his own. And this incubator, RevRo, that he had partnered with, they provided some fractional services.
Right.
So some marketing, some legal. But just again, talking about that loneliness of the founder, he was definitely all alone, and he was in Florida and this team was in Utah that was providing some support. So I'm big on functional ownership, diagramming out of the functional org chart. There needs to be an owner for each of those, even if it's only, it's one name in each box, but it might be just two people's names that's all over this
everywhere. right.
And so we did that early on, and then and my goal was, how do we get him to a place where his real strength and passion was in selling? And so what can I take off his plate? But I found very quickly, I have some strengths, I have a lot of weaknesses. I'd look at this org chart and say, man, if I could fire myself from most of these roles, I would, but I can't. And some, I own it and some accountable, but we got conversations. I'd say, Elliot, I can't, I'm not doing anything there, right? As long as I'm aware I own it, but it's literally just parked over there. I can't even think about it. So you got to stack rank every day.
What was the growth like then? I mean, going from one to two probably feels really good, but it doesn't mean you've got a full team at that point. So as you're explaining, was it steady? Was it sporadic? Did you try to shift quickly from the consumer into the ingredient method, or like, what did growth look like over the next couple of years?
Yeah. So interesting chapter. So I don't call it a pivot. I would call it an evolution or a graduation.
Yeah.
So when I joined, the company had been primarily e-commerce, so direct consumer, so company website, Amazon, and then some in the wholesale channel selling to retailers like sporting goods stores and retail dealers. And when I joined, there was inventory and we took on more inventory as a consumer brand. And early on, what really interested me was, again, let's be the Gore-Tex of moisture removal. Let's partner with dozens of really performance-driven brands looking to innovate.
they can create pouches, bags, sleeves, cases, like whatever gear you put inside. If there's moisture on or in the gear, from cameras to power tools to computers, you know, AirPods, hearing aids, military gear, whatever it is, if moisture is on or in it, that's really bad.
Yeah.
Right? It festers. You get electrical failure. You get lens fogging. You get rust corrosion. Pull that moisture out and trap it. So that's what our technology does. It's reusable. It's electricity free. So let's find those brands that want to do that. But what was this real challenge was, here we were with inventory, gun bags, pouches, and obviously a dire need to figure out how to sell it. And we were challenged for lots of different reasons. And all
because that's your cash. Your cash is tied up in inventory. Yeah.
Tied up in inventory, really struggling with digital marketing. So acquiring customers on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, Google, anything remotely tied to a firearm was like shadow banned or canceled or wouldn't be shown. And even just a bag, we weren't selling a gun. And so that made it really, really hard to acquire customers, you know, come to our website, convert them, and educate them about the uniqueness of this technology. It's rust prevention for a gun or for tools. So that was just really hard. Those early days are hard of educating. So the challenge, Jeff, was we've got the big vision was to be the Gore-Tex moisture removal and build this big platform of we have our IP, solves a huge problem, and then help brand, we call them brand partners, help brand partners go to market with these really innovative, cool new products that, that were only possible because of dryout. But how do we do that while being straddled with the challenges of inventory, wasn't really selling through, took on debt to pay for the inventory. And it was just two of us. And there was so much going on. So that was really challenging. So
did you also look into stuff like, because a lot of people at this stage, especially when they launch their product, they say, okay, option number one, I just want to license this technology and make some money and live my life. Option number two, somebody can buy it from me if it's a good price. And then the last option is I'm going to make the product and sell it to people. Yeah. And that's where people usually end up if they persist with it long enough, because those other two paths are really hard. But did you guys also, as you're doing the D2C version of the company that you joined, and thinking about the partnership, the brand partner approach. And by the way, you keep saying Gore-Tex, and they just like, I get the Gore-Tex side of it. But there's a second dimension to it. Gore-Tex is a waterproofing device. You guys are I didn't catch that until the most recent time you mentioned Gore-Tex. I'm like, oh, there's way more here than just a business model that you want to replicate. This is also a companion technology that you can sort of equate to in a sense. So we may get into that more. But did you guys also say, hey, what about just licensing it out? Like, were you just exploring these things, or was it pretty much we've got the one, we want to transition to the other, and that was the path?
I didn't know if licensing was the right model, mm-hmm. or if we would need to produce a finished good. Do we produce a ream of material and sell it to another brand, and then it would go to a factory, they would cut and sew. Right. So let's say if we had a camera gear bag, right? Because lenses get wet, batteries get wet. People who are photo enthusiasts, hobbyists, professionals, they use their cameras in all weather, right? All conditions. And then afterward, what do? You put it in your bag and it just sits there. That's one of many examples of, that's why there are billions and billions of dollars of products that are really ruined every year because of moisture.
Yeah.
Unintentionally. But what do we do if we're working with a camera gear bag company, for example? And I had a really interesting unlock. And you asked maybe it's on the icebreaker, when I'm grappling with something, where do I go to find answers? And mm-hmm. I'm constant networker, trying to pay it forward. I'm not just take, but have really good dialogue with smart people, especially if they're open about like, this is actually really hard. I don't bat 1,000. Like, I whiff a lot. I have broken bat, hits and all that. Like, it's hard. So just learn together and ask questions and be vulnerable. And I was introduced to
someone who had been in the an ingredient brand, mm-hmm. and the general manager of an ingredient brand, and she said at the end of the conversation, she said, "Can I give you some some key learnings that might be advice?" And I said, "Please, I'm a student of the game. Please,
yes,
yeah." She said, "I'm so excited to meet a fellow ingredient brand CEO," and she said, "If we had licensed our technology a long time ago, the IP runs its course and now it's no longer covered. And mm-hmm. someone, you know, they obviously couldn't, they don't have the patent protection." She said, "But also we have special know-how when we're making this ingredient, this material, that if we were, had taught companies that were buying our material, if we had taught them how to make it on their own or their factories, how to make it."
Yeah.
They wouldn't need us. They could just knock us off.
That would have been their own expiration.
Yes. So I realized in that moment, I said, "Thank you." Cause I've been grappling with, do we license, do we produce and sell something, finished product? And I said, "You just answered that question. Thank you so much." So the licensing component for us is any product that's launched with dry out. We do require a dry out, the brand to be on it. Mm-hmm. That makes it more premium because it has this functionality of, you know, active moisture management.
Right.
And so brand partners actually want it on there, but similar to, again, Gore-Tex on my snowboard jacket.
Yeah.
That's why I keep using that example, because we're pretty
familiar with it. That makes sense. Well, as you did this transition, as you built into the brand, the ingredient brand model, was it smooth? What were the rough spots to make that transition? In addition to managing cash that was tied up in your inventory, and like where did things go right, and where did they struggle?
So while we were struggling immensely to sell through our inventory, in part because domain expertise, sometimes it's good to be an outsider and come into a new industry because you see it with fresh eyes. You don't have preconceived notions. You don't think you have all the answers. You don't even care to ask the questions. But domain expertise, of course, can be extremely valuable because then you're authentic, you understand the consumer base. In this case, with a gun bag brand, I felt like a foreigner in a foreign land. Hmm. I wasn't my own customer to get gun bags, to need a gun bag. And so it was just all wrong. Like, we'd go to trade shows and we'd set up a booth and I was like, "Oh my gosh, they must look at me like..." I didn't pretend to be something that I wasn't, but I was excited about the bag, but I didn't really need it. And it was just, "Oh my gosh, this is so off." But we had inventory that we needed to sell. A really key moment in our story as a company is I called a board meeting. This was 3.5 years ago, so 18 months in.
Okay.
And I said, "This is going to be the longest board meeting we've ever had. I need 4 hours. And we have a lot to talk about." And I started it by saying, there are two themes for this meeting. The first is, there's this concept of strong opinions loosely held.
Okay.
Some of us have a very strong opinion and have had a strong opinion that being a gun bag company is right for us. Please hold that loosely. Second theme is good, better, best.
Okay.
And I said, in my view, and I'm going to make a case today, good, being a gun bag brand, is barely good. Being, again, the Gore-Tex of moisture removal, of an ingredient brand with this embedded technology, working with other companies, help them innovate and launch products. Being the Gore-Tex of moisture removal is best. And that's where we need to go. And then I said, you might completely disagree with me. This might be revealing that I'm the wrong guy and you should kick me off the bus. I shouldn't be, not only should I not be CEO, I shouldn't be on the bus, but please hear me out. I'm going to make a case for it. And so I then presented that and I said, okay, so what's this going to take? I said, one, we're going to go around the table and everyone gets a vote. I need to hear it, yay or nay. And we need to be aware of something. I don't know how long this is going to take. I don't know how hard it's going to be. But it's going to feel like we're barely flying. We finally are caught flight. We're in the air, but I'm going to steer the plane downward toward the ground.
Yeah.
It's going to appear like we're in a tailspin. And I believe we'll be able to pull up before we hit the ground with this new business model. But bear with me. We're going to run out of cash. We're going to run out of fuel. But I believe it's worth it. And the answer from all the board members was, you have our support, but go sell those gun bags. So that was 3.5 years ago. And
That pep talk resulted in just everybody saying, okay, let's go.
They said, let's go. They said, we agree, but we've got inventory. Go sell those gun bags.
Got it.
So then it was, and then I told the board and the founder, so I'm not going into hiding and I'm not reckless intentional. Well, maybe it was intentional recklessness, but I cannot even think about gun bags anymore. I need to spend 80% of my time on focus on building this platform with this new business model and ingredient brand strategy, working with OEMs, brands, and so bear with me. Just trust me on this one. And that was really hard for lots of reasons, because so many unknowns, education, credibility. And I would sit down with CEOs or heads of product of brands, and I showed them our little samples of products we're trying to sell. And they would be like, can you envision this in your own product? Sometimes I could, sometimes I couldn't. But what we lacked was data, is we had really cool stories of people, you know, went on a hunt and pheasant hunting or waterfowl hunting. And it was, my rifle was soaked. It fell in the pond or whatever. And then I put it in your bag and got home and opened it up. And it was like, it was dry and it was bone dry and it was, you know, no rust. Like, how'd you do that? So we had these success stories, but we needed data. And so, I was introduced to someone in the chemical engineering department here locally at the University of Utah. And we sat down and said, we need help getting performance data, best be third party independent. Can you help us, you know, show people how this performs compared to, we always compare to rice, bowl of rice for a phone or AirPods or whatever, silica gel packets, right? For other objects. Or like a plug-in dehumidifier you put in a gun safe. So they're different, you know, solutions for moisture management of devices and hard goods. But we had to show how much better dryout was. And so once we had that data, major unlock, then I could go back to these CEOs and these brands and say, like, look, this works. And they'd usually have their own success story of the pouch I gave them. It's like, oh, I was in a hot tub the other night and my son's phone that was on the side just slipped in and pulled it out. And that pouch you gave me? Yeah, did it work? Of course it works. You know, we get those stories all the time. So building the credibility took a long time.
I can only imagine how, I mean, you presented that story about going to the board meeting as like, hey, here's how we're doing it. I'll bet there were some nerves. There's a little bit of anxiety going in there saying, well, I know what I'm going to say, and I hope they respond the way I wanted to respond, but who knows, right? That's not an easy, you made it sound easier than I imagine it was. The other thing is the going back to the concept of putting the plane, you know, the already low flying plane into a tailspin, and then telling the board, hey, I can't focus on gun bags. I can't focus on selling D2C gun bags right now. I mean, that seems once they've bought into the decision of where the plane is going to go once it comes out of the tailspin, like it feels like a kind of a natural decision that they've already bought into to say, don't spend time on the D2C. That'd be like a pilot trying to save the plane coming, you know, going from a dive to saving it and saying, well, I don't have time to make sure everybody's got their seatbelt on. Somebody else better do that, right? I got other stuff I got to focus on, like the ground that's coming at us at 400 miles an hour or whatever it is. So that kind of seems like that maybe is a more naturally accepted position once the board is bought in. Is that fair to say it that way?
Yeah, unfortunately, we had built up some trust, some two-way trust, where we knew that we were doing our best and it just wasn't what we had wanted as a business.
Yeah.
You know, selling consumer products, it just wasn't. The use case was enormous. The market size, and also, by the way, I did team up with a really smart guy that helped me with a market sizing study before AI could just do that in, you know, 2 minutes in Claude. But that was huge too, to show like, okay, this is real. Now we've got to
find the brands, the brand partners in each of these various categories to convince them that they should launch their own products that have, that are engineered with drought to solve this moisture problem. So we started to talk with people who were military suppliers. I mean, think about drones, optics, drone controllers, the goggles, you know, night vision optics,
yeah,
of course, guns and ammo, sensitive equipment is what they call it. There's so many electronics now that are exposed to moisture all the time, and it's a huge problem. And they're already buying bags and, you know, kits and cases and all that. So how can our technology provide an extra benefit? You know, you think about gear protection, and there have been these two categories of either we make the gear itself waterproof, which is really hard to do typically, or we provide a protective case like a Pelican case.
Yeah.
We literally have created and pioneered a third category in gear protection, which is active moisture removal. It's literally a new category. But educating brands about that, what's nice is I had a call with two different companies this morning, potential brand partners in very different industries. One is storage and organizing in like buildings, and the other is in outdoor sports where you're playing with a lot of water, outdoor recreation. Mm-hmm. And of course they get it. Like, yeah, stuff just, it gets wet all the time. Either when you're engaged in that activity, whether it's fly fishing or hunting or whatever, or, you know, law enforcement with gear that comes in after a day of rain or whatever, and it just gets, sits in a locker and it's wet. So you get it. But to, so one of the beauties too of what we're able to do with dryout is explain what dryout does, and they view it through the context of their world and the problems we're trying to solve related to moisture, and they see that.
That makes sense. And when you say you back it up with data, because like at a just a technical level, does it make sense that you can dry stuff out better than it's drying out now? Yeah, for sure. That like there are probably a couple ways to do that. Dry out, of course, it being the better one, right? Now we know that. But the data tells that story. And I actually was on your website recently, and I saw a little intro video that you have for your company. Mm-hmm. And when I saw you actually say a number up there. And you say it's this many times better. And I saw that and I'm like, my first reaction was, not everybody knows how percentages work. Are these the right percentages? Because these are awfully high percentages.
Yeah.
It was like 3,500 times better than, I don't remember what the reference point was. You know, I think it was silica gel packs or something like that.
Yeah.
Did I get that? Am I in the right range there?
Yeah. Yeah, so just to level set, a panel of, so this is, hasn't launched yet, but a brand partner we're working with, and they've announced the partnership, but Pelican, world leader in protective hard cases for
awesome.
For
congratulations.
Amazing product. Yeah, just phenomenal. So this panel right here, we took a panel, this engineered with dryout. So you just lay it over the gear inside a hard case where you're organizing. You might have different, you know, slots in the foam for photo gear, drones, whatever. And then you lay it over the gear and then close up the top. And it now provides moisture management. That the way dryout works, it pulls moisture from 6 inches away out of or off of the gear. And it's like a capillary action. Then it spreads it out across the surface. That's why it has a really high absorption capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So it pulls it, spreads it out, traps it. And then later, the moisture is released when you expose this to sunlight or direct heat or forced airflow.
Yeah.
And, but so anyway, that's an explanation of how it works. But what we did, Jeff, is with the University of Utah in their lab, is a smaller panel than this that's 6 by 12 inches, going head to head against a silica gel packet, a canister of silica gel, rice. Yeah, it performed 3,400 times, not percent, but times more. It absorbed that much more moisture than a silica gel packet, which really is kind of the incumbent. That's what we're competing with.
Yeah.
Military will throw silica gel packets inside a Pelican case and it's almost pointless. It doesn't pull it out of a, you know,
the pack that comes in my, I don't know, in the, you know, box of new shoes that I bought that you're telling me can't pull it out of a, can't pull the moisture out of the inside of my phone.
No,
surprising.
We have the data to prove that. So that was significant, is be able to show that. And then what we do whenever we launch a new product with a brand is before, in the prototyping process of that finished good, we actually get data of how the performance of that product. So can I give another example?
Yeah, please. So
there's a company that is, by the time this podcast goes live, they will have launched. So I can say this, but okay. UAG is a brand that sells mobile device accessories like phone cases. Awesome brand. And
pretty sure that's this brand.
Yeah, that's
here.
It. Shout out to UAG. It's not a paid sponsorship. Maybe it should be. Great company, great brand. And they've been attacking this, you know, ruggedization of like protect your phone, protect your gear, your accessories. I have a really rugged case for my AirPods that's, you know, that's made out of, it's really cool. It's like military spec drop stuff, like cool stuff. So they've approached this gear protection from the ruggedization standpoint for drops and all that. Well, now here we came and said, we can help you solve another, you know, provide another benefit, which is protecting after moisture damage. And so this product is the phone rescue pouch, which is the 2026 version of the original invention years ago by Elliot, the founder, that he patented. So to have it come that far, you know, open it up, put a wet phone, AirPods, key fob, whatever, hearing aids in here, keep it in there for a few hours, pulls the moisture out.
Then you pull the phone out, you let the bag dry separately. But somebody else now is carrying the inventory. Somebody else now is integrating it in. They're doing the distribution. You guys are now the brand ingredient or the ingredient brand that goes along with UAG.
And here's another unlock. You have a question? I have another breakthrough.
No, go ahead.
So another breakthrough is we had an interesting aha moment and we try to be good at pattern recognition, which is hard when everything's new and you're, again, laying down slats as you're sprinting as fast as you can across this bridge and you're laying down slats. And if there aren't two or three slats ahead of you, you make sure your stride is long enough that you can at least land, but then what? And a lot of blind spots. And we had this aha unlock moment, this breakthrough moment, when I was talking with the CEO of an outdoor products brand and they want to get into soft goods and sell, whether it's a pouch or, you know, bags, backpacks and all that, engineered with dryout, like with the tech pocket in there.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of, it was stagnant. It wasn't moving. They were excited. We were excited. And I finally just called the CEO and I said, can I have a really open conversation with you? And said, who on your team is designing this? Like, when's it going to get going? He said, oh, we don't have anybody. I said, wait, you don't have a designer for these products you want to do with dryout? And he said, no, we don't. And I said, if we found just a contractor, 1099, third party, that can design soft goods like a pack, and we can design with your input, would you pay for that? And he said, oh, of course. Yeah, that would be amazing. Because we already had a requirement, back to the advice I got from this other ingredient brand, which is we need to work with our own manufacturers, who we trained on how to engineer and construct, you know, soft goods like bags and pouches engineered with dry out to protect our intellectual property and also quality control, quality assurance, make sure it works as intended.
Yeah.
But this middle piece, like you have a concept, you have production. It was, well, how do you now start ideating, designing, prototyping? And we realized, oh, if we offer that service, design and prototyping, that is a much faster path. Talk about, you know, speed to market, but path to revenue for us. And
instead of waiting for these big brands to move
or
at their
a small
pace.
Brand, right? Either it's a big brand with a 3-year roadmap.
Yeah.
And how in the world do you fit in as a Skunkworks project? You don't, even if the CEO is behind it.
Right.
Or a smaller brand, which is nimble and opportunistic, but they're resource constrained.
Right.
And so my COO, who has been an absolute game changer for the company and life changer for me, just unbelievable. Just wow. Shout out to Tyler. He's amazing. But early on, he said, I wonder if at some point we'll have a product designer on our team. And I just said, dude, we got to keep this as, you know, as asset light, as lean a team as possible. The brands we're working with, hopefully we'll have that. And then I went back to him and said, Tyler, you are 100% right. You are 100% right. That's a great service we can provide. And so we've since partnered with a third party that has world-class design and relationships with manufacturers in different parts of the world.
so that we now it's like plug and play. And we actually, this is part of the platform we built. So we call it DDP, design, development, and production.
Okay.
So that's why I'm referring to Dryout is much more than just an advanced material.
Yeah.
Dryout is a platform of embedded technology for active moisture removal, where a brand can be like, yep, we want to do this, this, and this as concepts, a pack, a sleeve, a pouch. In fact, let's do 3 backpacks of different sizes and have a tech sleeve. Here's our design aesthetic, and we can just go. It's fast.
And it sounds like this is just the natural result of what you didn't envision the DDP, the platform,
no,
in the form it's in. But when you tell this story, it seems pretty apparent where some of the pieces are, where they came from, and this tension between controlling your IP versus trying to minimize your own supply chain, stuff. The balance is, if you want to control your IP more, you have to control more of the supply chain, and then you become more of a platform, and now you've got this company that has the offerings that kind of flow out of the platform approach. Like,
yeah,
I love hearing, because prior to talking about this and the times we chatted, I didn't know all these details, but all of these things kind of come together to say the company is a lot more than just a moisture wicking product of some sort, right? This is like the company, and the business model is way more intricate. Just like a really good invention is always way more intricate in how it works and how it came together than just simply, this is a faster XYZ, right? So the details really are the characters in the story, in a way. And I love hearing about how they come together.
Yeah. And we're not the invention of a light bulb by Edison. We're not the 5,000 failures by Dyson before the
don't shortchange him. I think he says like 10,000, doesn't he?
Okay. Whatever it is.
I don't know.
It's remarkable.
Yeah.
We're not that, but it's been being on that journey and just moving forward and taking the blows, self-inflicted wounds, right? Sometimes are the most painful, but just being adaptable and flexible and to learn as we go. And we're still building a lot of it, laying slats on the bridge and widening the bridge.
Yeah.
But we really feel like it's very, very scalable. So you're an IP attorney and you understand how powerful the moat of intellectual property is. The second moat that we're building, which I think is really important, maybe more important, the second moat is the brand. Being known as the brand, sometimes being first mover in a category works against you, right? Mm-hmm. You wake sleeping giants, the second or third comer, they do better because they've seen your mistakes, or they
better, faster, cheaper.
Whereas in this case, our thesis is by coming out with brands like UAG, which is one of the top in their category, Pelican with 50% market share, both commercial, consumer, but also military and government worldwide, is we're fortunate to partner with brands that are top in their category. And then there's the billboard effect, right? You and I learned about Gore-Tex by seeing a Columbia rain jacket, right?
Yep.
A Burton snowboard jacket, North Face pants, right? Solomon shoes, you get it. And so we have that opportunity to build that moat so that if someone were to say, we can do it ourselves, then it feels like a me too, or the copycat just feels like a wannabe, and you'd be almost embarrassed to have that in your product.
Oh, I love this. I love this, Romney. It's like you've painted a picture that I was a little curious when we started. I kept thinking, well, it'll be good to catch up with Romney and see where he's at and what's going on. But you've now painted this legitimate picture with kind of the intricacies of what you're doing that is really exciting. I bet your team has grown, your revenues have probably grown, your board of directors from that meeting. What did you say? 3.5 years ago.
Yeah, it was 3.5 years ago. Yeah.
What's the trajectory now of the team and the business?
Yeah, the trajectory is really strong. We've had liftoff, and we've had there are some confidential apologies in my answer. It's a little bit evasive, but
sure.
We've had multiple purchase orders from multiple brand partners, some of which are they're known, right? They're live.
And then others are under NDA and don't want anyone in the world to know until there's a launch date. But it's cool because we're across so many categories. We also have, it's impossible to forecast any opportunity, in my opinion, in the government channel, right? Military. But we're fortunate.
That's either on or off, right?
Yeah, like, it could be enormous. It could be life-changing for a company, or it could be zero.
Yeah.
So my board's been patient about that. And one of our investors actually is a $6.5 billion supplier of mission critical gear to the federal government and military. So they know a thing or two about it. And so they've been great at helping us navigate and understand that landscape and have the right perspective. But we're fortunate that we designed a combat helmet bag that the special operations command in the Marine Corps, it's called MARSOC. They saw that and said, wait a minute, the helmet can get wet, but the gear on top should not stay wet. The night vision goggles are mounted, the communications gear, there's a laser, there's a light, there's a battery. That's expensive stuff. And the warfighter's life depends on it working and not having any issues related to moisture. And you can't control the weather. Obviously, most people in the military say, like, I was always wet, right?
Right.
And some is just sweat and condensation because you're in Fort Benning, right, in Georgia. So we have an opportunity now supplying this combat helmet bag. And that happened really fast. And so we've had these validators along the way. They're now turning into purchase orders. And then we, another group in the military saw that helmet bag and said, wait a minute, a combat helmet bag, expensive and important to keep that dry. Do you know how much aviation helmets cost? They're $300,000 to $500,000 because it's got like the built-in display and like intense all the electronics. That shouldn't stay wet. Whether it's even, you know, condensation because you're up and down in elevation,
right,
or whatever. So we've designed a helmet bag that's being tested there. So long-winded answer, but we see a lot of opportunity, both commercial and consumer brands, but then defense suppliers. And we're not looking to be a direct supplier to the federal government. We'd rather partner with proven suppliers that are already in, they're supplying product, they have distribution, they have credibility, they have relationships. And we just help them either make their bags and pouches better, or if you're a drone manufacturer and you're getting input from the field that your drone's amazing, thank you, but that controller's not waterproof, the goggles aren't waterproof. We keep it in a Pelican between uses because it's, or training missions, because that keeps it safe. But what if we put it in the Pelican and there's moisture on it and starts to, you know, there's rust and corrosion around the propeller or there's whatever, lens fogging on the goggles. So we now can design soft goods like packs and pouches and all that for these hard good companies, if that makes sense. So it becomes an accessory to what they're doing, which is really cool.
Makes total sense. And I'm thinking about last time I went scuba diving, I bought some gear and have my regulator and my computer or stuff like that. And I ended up buying like a neoprene water bottle holder to put my computer into, just in between, partly, you know, for impact issues, but as I've gone scuba diving, I'm like, these guys will take their air and they'll blow out their regulator trying to get the water out of it. And I'm thinking I might need to go see if there are any consumer facing products from a company that might have something that would be great to throw in there with my regulator computer in my bag. So,
yeah, and as things play out, we're hopeful that there'll be multiple options to solve, to address this moisture problem in tons of categories through different brands, right? So you wouldn't come to try out for that solution as a consumer, but we hope that brands will
somebody will have that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I ask, you've been very, very gracious with your time here. I really appreciate that, Romney. Can I ask, is there any way in which the journey over the last 5 years or the last 3.5 years from that board meeting that this is, change the way that you're looking at your own leadership position or qualities or outlook for the company?
I was talking to a CEO coach several years ago, and he asked me, what's my leadership style? And I said, well, I aspire to be a servant leader. And he said, great, what does that mean to you? And I said, well, I wouldn't ask a team member to do something I would be willing to do. And I check ego at the door. I do what's right for the company. Not just when there's, you know, not just looking out for self-interest. And so he said, okay, that's interesting. And then 10 minutes later, he said, so what are you grappling with? What's keeping you up at night? And I said, there's a member of my leadership team. And by the way, I'm not referencing my current leadership team. I said, this was years ago. I said, there's a member of the team that's just not cutting it. It's not a cultural fit, unwilling to be accountable, but I'm letting them get away with it. And it's easier to not address it because we need that function to be led and the team is pretty good. And he said, I want to stop you right there. Remember how you said you were a servant leader? And I said, well, I try to be. And he said, then why are you letting your ego get in the way and the avoidance of contention and a hard conversation? You know you need to make a change. If you're a servant leader, wouldn't you have the best interest of your company in mind and you wouldn't worry about, you know, hurting his feelings or having a hard conversation? And I said, oh my gosh, yes. And that's probably the right thing for him as well. If it's not a great fit, he's probably miserable. And I'm not doing a good job of leading and managing. And so that has helped me a lot to have hard conversations sooner and understanding, you know, the lens of this is what's right for the company. And it's hard. And I hate having moments where people feel like they've disappointed me or that they're not succeeding. But when you have to have a conversation, you have to have a hard conversation. So that's been really important.
I love that. It adds a different depth to what we typically think of when we're like, oh, you know, I'm a servant leader. I try. I think a lot of times people say that and it's like, I try to be a giving person. But this mentor of yours added a different depth to that, right? It's not just being a giving person, not just having good intentions. It's about putting other things like the company and the employees ahead of you, which means having those hard conversations that you don't want to have instead of putting your feelings about the conversation itself ahead of the outcome that you need to have. It's a depth that's not there sometimes when we're talking about, you know, surface level servant leadership.
And I had multiple team members on that leadership team who in my one-on-ones with them, they would say, when I would say basically, how can I help you more? How can I be a better leader? And a couple said, dude, you hold me to this really high bar and I love it. Like we're doing big things and we're literally shooting for the moon. But you let this guy get away with murder.
Yeah.
And it's kind of hard. Like I'm self-driven, self-motivated. So it's hard. I do it anyway, but I got to admit it's kind of hard. And I just said, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Yeah. Lazy leadership on my part.
Well, thank you for sharing that reflection. That's not hard to tell those stories sometimes, or not easy to tell those stories sometimes. But I'm really excited for where you're going, though. I'm excited that you shared this journey, shared the insights. This is a cool story, and I'm excited to see where you go. I imagine if we meet up 5 years from now or 3 years from now, you'd be like, Jeff, guess what? All that stuff I couldn't tell you back then, we landed it. And those government contracts that we wanted to land that. Who knew if they're going to come through? We've been doing them now for 2 years, and sounds like you're on a great trajectory with the business.
Yeah, we're very hopeful. It's coming together. Still a lot of work to do for sure. Our BHAG, the big Heritageous Gold, right? Goal, excuse me. The Everest we're trying to climb is by 2033 for dry out to be in every household in North America, and protecting every member of the U.S. Armed Forces. So pretty big BHAG. And I'm hopeful that you and I look back in 5 years and get a better sense of if we're on track.
I love it. I imagine when we do reconnect, the question I'm going to now be able to ask you is, hey, what percent are you at? Where are you at on that?
Not
right now. I'll ask you in a year, or I'll ask you next time we chat. I'll be like, how's that percentage increasing? You know?
Yeah.
I know you'll be measuring it. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Romney, it's been really great. Again, thank you for your time. I know you're busy with a lot of stuff. I really enjoyed catching up and chatting, and I'm so grateful that you're willing to share insights here so that we can share them with our audience and let other people who are maybe grappling with some of the same issues or similar things hear what you've done and how it worked out for you, and hopefully it'll be helpful for them.
Thank you. Yeah, happy to pay it forward. I've had a lot of really smart, kind people who have helped me with advice along the way. If it helps anyone, that makes me happy.
Fantastic. And thanks to our audience for joining us again on this week's episode of The Breakout CEO.
Thanks, Jeff.
Be sure to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And if you enjoy the show, a rating or a review goes a long way. Our mission is to promote the stories of breakout CEOs in scaling SaaS, e-commerce, and tech companies to equip peer CEOs with valuable perspectives and confidence. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of The Breakout CEO. I'm Jeff Holman, and I'll see you next time.